Would you let it go? I cannot end this morning of my life. Show me how the gods kill.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 54. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from August 13th, 2014. The Devilers number 2 and Clive Barker's Next Testament number 12. As always, we also have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we welcome Eisner-nominated designer Chris Ross, director of digital publishing for Top Shelf Productions. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers ahead.
Here's a spoiler. I'm sitting across the table from you right now.
Worst show ever.
No, it's going to be awesome.
Who else is here?
Oh, also another Eisner-nominated Chris, as a matter of fact.
We only allow Eisner-nominated Chris's.
Yeah, I thought you got my name wrong.
There's this other guy. He's hanging out with us. You may have heard of him. His name's Chris Sabella. He writes some books. What do you write? What are you writing these days?
High Crimes, Ghost, Alien vs. Predator.
You got a big announcement that just came out, and
Escape from New York.
Ooh, super exciting.
And various other things.
And you're crashing the party, which is so fucking rad. I'm super glad you're here.
It's only 2 hours away. Honestly, I didn't think you guys were going to take me up. Like, I said it as a larf, like, and then suddenly it was happening.
I drove 8 hours to come here. You drove 2.
Yeah.
So, I mean, on a scale of ridiculous things to do on a Thursday.
But you're staying. Like, you're not.
True.
Yeah, there's a couch.
No, that's okay.
No, this is great. And you read the books that we're talking about, so.
Well, yeah, sort of.
Sort of.
Close enough.
That's about right for us, too.
Hey, I read everything that we're talking about. I read most of what we're talking about today. Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week's theme, we're going to try to stick to it. Is The Gods Must Be Crazy. We're talking about two books that illustrate how fucked up the powers that be or not to be really are. And they definitely hold a grudge against us women and men created in their image. So much so that sometimes it's not clear whether we're talking about the good guys or the bad guys, the gods or the demons themselves. Oh, comics. I think I see what you did there.
This is M Says Hello from Twitter. I'm responding to the question on which god or gods in comics would you choose your deity and why. I would choose Ranma Krishna. I think that's it. The one that basically manipulates a dead man, Boston Rant, and uses him as her own personal troubleshooter. Primarily because I'd like to spend some time in the semi-mystical place of Nanda Parbat, where Richard Dragon and others are. Mostly so that I can just, like, chill for a couple of decades without getting any older. Probably too greedy of me, but that would be my selection. So, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating what we love and occasionally what we snark about comics. This week, we asked you to tell us about some of your favorite gods in comics, including the ones you'd want to claim as your own, given the chance. Each episode, you can call, Skype, or email your confessions to us. The details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
That was a nice pause.
It was a pregnant pause.
This is a message for the wonderful, beautiful, magnificent tropical fish that is Andrea and also Aaron. This is Allison Barry, the gentleman. I'm calling to answer your question about gods or gods that I would want as my personal deity from comics. And I have two choices. The first would be Odin, who is also probably my preferred deity in real life, because he's Odin. He has the Odin force. He commands the nine realms. He has an eye patch. He's Odin. I really shouldn't have to explain it. And the other deity that is probably a terrible idea to want, but you can't question her effectiveness, is none other than Granny Goodness. I mean, she kind of makes a case for why child labor can work and surrounds herself by really strong with really strong and empowered women. And, you know, the brainwashing and the murder of innocence aside, pretty effective. I'm just saying is all. Have a good night, guys. Bye.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Andrea Schock and Aaron at Aaron Myers and Chris at Xtop, X-T-O-P. The show account is at Comics Therapy. I really can't believe I'm sitting in your office right now. I really do question my life decisions, like, on a regular basis. But yeah, this is a good one, I think.
I guess.
I mean, so far nobody's died.
Right. I mean, you've been here for an hour, so that's not really saying much.
And I'm not drunk.
Yet.
Yet.
Thanks, guys.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that. we need to talk about Guardians, because you wouldn't let me talk about it last week, and Chris saw it too. So, go.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go against the grain here and say it was a pretty good movie.
Hmm. I haven't heard anybody say that, really.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I don't think it was, you know, the sort of second coming of entertainment, but...
Where does it fit in your, like, all Marvel movies ever?
It's pretty high up there. Like, I think the thing I like best about it is that you don't... I mean, it feels like, for the most part, you don't have to know... I didn't know shit about Guardians of the... I mean, I knew there was a tree and a raccoon.
Right.
I didn't know about... Like, I knew...
Yeah, you never read the book. Backstory.
Yeah, I've never read the book. I didn't know the backstory. And yet, like that feels like how superhero movies should be handled from now on. It's like just get in. And
I think Marvel had a much bigger need to introduce those characters properly to people, too. It's not like Thor that, like, most people would have an idea, like, who Thor is, whether they know Thor's,
right,
like, backstory or not. They know he's a dude with a big hammer and lightning, etc. Like, Star-Lord, people don't really know who Star-Lord is.
Well, yeah, that's the nice thing about it, is, like, you don't have to cater to, like, the sort of slavish, like, fan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't screw this up. Like, or, you know,
right,
the reason that we've now had, like, 3 Spider-Man origin films.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
true.
He can never have too many Spider-Man
films. Like, my favorite, as terrible as that Edward Norton Hulk movie was, they do all the Hulk exposition in the opening credits.
Yeah.
And I was like, perfect. Like,
right,
you can follow that along enough to understand that a dude got zapped with some stuff. And now he turns into this great monster.
Which is, like, what we all want to see anyway.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm, like, as bad as, like, the rest of that movie was, like, they totally handled the exposition great.
I actually thought the exposition in Guardians was a little on the slow side. And I know that that's probably not a super popular opinion, but, like, it took them a long time to get the band together.
Yeah, but, yeah, it's the first movie. Like, they're gonna...
Right?
I didn't have a problem with...
Did you have any other problems with it?
Yeah, I definitely think... I mean, and countless people have talked about the Green Horror line, which really, like...
Oh, my God.
Like, that just, like, super took me out of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, it was... so, yeah, that was super problematic. For a movie that otherwise was, like... And I know, like... other people have problems with the role of women in that movie,
mm-hmm,
and, like, nothing overtly...
As they probably do with women in most, like, mainstream superhero comics.
Yeah, but this was an opportunity to do something,
sure,
different. If you haven't listened to Joe and Matt's Answer of the Week, the Two-Headed Nerds Answer of the Week this week, I think they said everything that needs to be said about that, so go listen to that. We don't have to talk about it now,
mm-hmm,
but I was a little bummed about her.
Yeah, and I mean...
Her lack of, I don't know, oomph. Like, she really, of all of them, got the short end of the stick.
Yeah.
From a nerd standpoint, I guess, like, if you're a Guardians nerd, which is not the majority, it's not like,
mm-hmm,
Iron Man or Thor or something like that, but, like, Gamora, especially if you're following along with the Marvel comics that basically serve as a lead-up to the movie, you know, to get people interested in it.
Right.
Like, Gamora is portrayed, and this is her character, as the one of the fiercest warriors in the universe.
Right.
Like, she should be kicking everyone's ass, and in the movie, she kind of got her ass kicked quite a bit.
Yeah.
Right.
But she got saved, like, twice, so,
mm-hmm,
you know, there you go.
Right.
It's fine. I had a lot of fun. I took Avi. We laughed. We cried. We listened to the music.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was... kind of a blast. I'm excited that you saw it, like, at a reasonable amount of time so we could talk about it. So good job.
Yeah.
Mostly thank you, Chrissy, for
yes.
that.
Well, it was a belated Father's Day present.
For you and Yvonne?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Forgot to cash that in.
did she tell you, like, on Father's Day, like, we're going to do this?
I got a coupon.
Oh, that's so cute. Uh-huh. Oh, good job.
Yeah.
What else do we have to talk about?
Comics.
Okay.
Like
anything?
Like this week?
I don't know. Anything going on in your life?
I bought a lot of comics.
You always buy a lot of comics?
Sold a lot of comics.
That's not atypical.
Yeah.
I drove to fucking Oregon to sit across from you and talk to you, so that's...
You're lucky.
A thing that
mm-hmm.
I did this week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I mean, what else do you need?
I
tried to clean the house up a little bit.
You provide a stable amount of predictability in my life, Aaron Myers, and I am grateful for it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, this is a typical amount of social interaction that I'm tried to prepare for.
How are you doing with that?
Okay. We've got...
Is that what we're doing?
You brought whiskey, yeah. I mean, I can handle it a lot better when it's my house.
Okay.
And there's places to retreat to.
And whiskey.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it only goes so far, especially when it's summer and you can dehydrate pretty quick. But
that's fine.
You know, everything in moderation, I guess.
Anything fun that you want to share for your life this week?
I mean...
me?
Yeah.
Oh, we're talking about Chris.
I'm done with you. Okay. You have nothing going on.
Mm.
Comics, kids... It's like same old, same old.
Sure.
Yeah, no, I've just been sort of working. I'm like lettering High Crimes number 8 right now, so that's a bummer. issue 9 is a real bummer, but it's starting to head into bummer town.
It's never really been like an up with people.
Yeah, but like when I went up, so like right when I got back from San Diego, a friend of mine was like, hey, can you come dog sit? In Seattle, and I was like, yeah, that sounds great. Like, go to Seattle for a week. I did not realize that, like, the dog cannot be left alone at any time.
Oh, so you're not really in Seattle, you just drove to a house.
I'm technically in Seattle, but yeah, I'm locked inside a house with this dog. Like, so we went to the dog park. I snuck him into Starbucks once, and that was about it. So
does that hinder your, like, can you get work done if you're in a quiet house with a dog?
It's harder for me. Like, I need...
You really seem to thrive on...
I'm getting better, though. Like, the last couple times I've gone to my old office at night, like, I just can't get shit done anymore.
The internet loves it when you do that, man.
Yeah, I feel bad that I've let the internet down, but, like, I'm saving gas money, and, like, you know, it's like a 20-minute drive each way, so I'm saving 40 minutes that I'm probably wasting. So.
Oh, man. Didn't you? You used to live much closer, right? I thought it was walkable. I thought that was the
no.
sort of beauty of the place.
It was walkable at one point, and then it wasn't, and now it's super not walkable.
Got it.
I've just been working all week, so, like, coming up to Eugene was like, oh, well, that sounds dumb.
I know. It's
yeah,
amazing.
I, like, hung out at what Aaron described to me as, like, the crack town part of Eugene.
Oh.
Which is basically just lots of white people with dreadlocks.
Hmm. Is it near the university?
Mm-mm. No,
it's literally right next to some train tracks.
Yeah, it's,
like,
right, it's across the tracks.
Oh.
Yeah, like, when the train comes by, everybody covers their ears, because it is splittingly loud.
Wow.
I did give you 2 options. I told you
but I'm always going to go for Cracktown.
Right.
Like,
I mean, I knew you would, but
yeah.
I wanted to cover my...
How did
my
you pitch the alternative to Cracktown?
I said it was a nice, like, fancy, probably quiet...
I barely looked at that one. Like, as soon as, like, he was like, yeah, this is sort of a sketchy part of town. I was like, that's the one for me.
Yeah.
Did you make new friends?
I did. A guy gave me marijuana in exchange for a cigarette. So,
wow.
Yeah. Like, I'm normally, like, I have to squeeze a quarter out of people who want to bum a cigarette. And this dude was just like, can I borrow a cigarette? I'll give you a nug. And I was like, well, this is ridiculous enough that I'm going to say yes. They did. He just, like, pulled out his bag and, like, just threw, like, a big nugget of weed.
Tell me that he said, can I borrow a cigarette, really?
Or have. I don't know.
I hope he said borrow.
People say that all the time, though. Like,
what is that? Then do you give it back?
Well, that's also, like, people who go, like, hey, do you have an extra cigarette? And it's like, no, they only come 20 a pack. Like, they... They're never, like, accidentally 22 in there. Like, that's when I would have an extra.
One for you and one for
a
friend.
So, So that was nice. Like, you know,
that's actually smart. And mm-hmm. cigarette manufacturers start doing that. Like, here's your 20 and here's one to pass on. Like,
to get someone started.
Introduce somebody to cigarettes.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, that was, I just drank coffee and, like, was going over lettering proofs for AVP2, answering emails. So,
cool.
And then after this, I'm going to eat food and drive back to Portland. So.
That's a Thursday right there.
Yeah, yeah. I've had worse Thursdays.
Mm-hmm. I hope so.
I've had better Thursdays.
Oh, fuck
Zing.
You.
Hey, I mean, considering the attractions and opportunities in Eugene, that's you didn't do
it's
too
true.
Bad.
It's true.
Yeah, I've only been here once before, and the last time was to see when Conan O'Brien came to town.
Oh, uh-huh.
You know what's going to make your day is if we have waffles for dinner.
Really?
Yeah. Yes.
I don't think you understand my day then. That's not really good, unless there's chicken on top of it.
Sure.
Yeah. These are very delightful waffles.
Yeah.
They're not like breakfast waffles. They're
still waffles.
I mean, yeah,
no.
In the end, they're waffles.
They almost need another category. They're that good.
Yeah. I was at Safeway earlier this week, and they are now selling like glazed waffles as a donut alternative.
No, these aren't like that. These are like
just
a meal.
Are boring.
Yeah, like why would you want to eat a boring ass donut when you could eat a waffle that was cooked, you know, 7 hours ago and then lacquered with sugar?
Safeway.
It was tempting.
Well, talking about comics make your day?
Sure, why not?
Okay, let's talk about comics.
Okay.
Hi. I'm Ben Drew Rondale. You may remember me from such films as Alligator Hands and Alligator Hands 2, Wrath of Salmon. But today I'm here to talk about God. And I don't mean the new Oliver Stone biopic. Comics Therapy asked, if you could choose any god in comics to worship, who would it be? Well, this out-of-work thespian has just one answer to that. He's the most powerful being in Marvel Comics, greater than Thanos, Galactus, or even Squirrel Girl. I'm talking the one above all, whose appearance in Fantastic Four number 511 resembled the late, great Jack King Kirby, co-creator of just about the entire Marvel Universe. And if anyone deserves us nerds on Humble Knee, it's Jack. Until next time, Gloob Night, America. Gloob. God damn it, Gary. You typoed the word thingy. Teleprompter. That's it. You nearsighted best.
Our first book this week is The Devilers number 2, written by Joshua Hale Fialkov, drawn by Matt Triano, and colored by Mark Roberts. Simon Bullard did the letters. The Devilers is published by Dynamite Press.
I didn't do any write-ups for, like, updates or summaries this week.
Well, then you better tell me what it's about.
I don't know. Aaron, did you read it?
Yeah, but I don't do the summaries. I read the names incorrectly.
Yeah, and I make fun of you for that.
And then
I
do
the summaries. Right. And you, yeah, okay.
Right, so back to you, Andrea.
Right. It is a reluctant band of, you know, demon killers.
Sure.
That represent a variety of the world's religions.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have, no, all of them have superpowers, except there's like that one hangers-on guy who's just, I don't really know why he's there.
Which
you should really write the press release.
What is his name? The extra guy.
Yeah, maybe.
No. He did the guy that he went to. Oh,
the guy he's talking to, like in the first issue.
And then he goes with them.
Does he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he goes with them.
I read issue 2 pretty fast, so maybe
yep.
I missed.
They meet the demon. That's it's okay because he's on
right,
the far
right.
side.
Yeah.
And they all go
mm-hmm.
and. Yeah, he's still there, and he's providing, I assume, his role is to give us, like, a non-powered, non-religious outlook to provide commentary.
Well, he is the
right,
he's
but
the
did
skeptic.
You read the issue?
Yeah.
Okay. Because then he does have powers.
No.
No, she's talking about
talking
the dude
about
he's
the...
talking with.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I got the two guys.
The skeptic.
Yes.
Like,
but
that's what
you.
He provides.
The skeptic. He provides us the, yes.
Right.
Thank you.
But that's it's immediately, question. Like, diffused.
It is. I'm not, in case it's not obvious, I find his presence to be a little bit, you know, wearisome.
I mean, it makes sense from a storytelling point of view. Like,
sure.
If you have the one dude who everybody, like, we as readers can relate to.
Exactly.
And in terms of, like, representation of beliefs and thoughts, he would be the, you know.
That's a good point. He does provide that other actual perspective of, on the belief spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Sure. In terms of this story, too, it doesn't necessarily negate his... I mean, in terms of a strict theological kind of mindset or, you know, denier thereof, obviously he's wrong in terms of this.
Right. When you have a skeptical character who's then literally climbing into the bowels of hell, that's a potential for commentary. You know, comic relief right there.
Right. Or in terms of, like, what, if you're writing it from a particularly religious standpoint, you could say, like, no matter what, you know, the skeptic could deny that which is in front of him, mm-hmm. but it doesn't make it any less true.
I think the, since we're talking about the role of the gods this week, I think that the portrayal of hell being an obvious, so far, kind of like overwhelmingly Judeo-Christian perspective right now is interesting given the like roles on this little team of misfits that they've put together. So not being anywhere near a religious scholar whatsoever, and I'm like just fucking bunk when it comes to
that's
that
not
sort
one
of
your
thing.
Degrees.
It's really not. Okay. It's like way at the bottom of things that I can even pretend to talk about.
Mm.
I know.
As a man of God. Because I am an ordained minister.
You are. I saw
it
on the internet.
I feel like I am perfectly qualified to talk about
this.
Oh,
good. Because, you know, it hasn't been long enough since you've mansplained something to me. So that's
I'm
going to
God-splain stuff to you today.
Fucking A.
That's taking it one step further.
My only point was that
my point being that men are one step below
yeah,
God.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
My turn to talk?
Yes.
Okay. I would like to see more recognizable symbolism from some of the other religions. I think that would be actually super cool.
Yeah,
so,
right, the war, I guess, and whatever, you know, this explosion of hell and heaven and everything else into the earth maybe has a lot more potential to spill over into other realms, too.
Yeah, actually, when you saw the demons, like, I don't know. Again, I don't know shit. Let me just say that a bunch of times. But there were not a lot of, like, visual representations of the demons that jumped out at me as, like, intentionally indicative of some of the other religious beliefs that have been mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think if that was an intention, that could have been more clear. So, therefore, it makes me think that it wasn't.
Okay. I mean, it's also early in the series, too, so
yeah.
I don't know if that... Yeah, I don't know. I think that's a valid point. And it also, whenever it becomes one of these, like... There was actually a pretty good miniseries not too long ago called Shoot First. It was a Dark Horse book that was about like a group of anti-religious kind of, not mercenary, like government people who, because all the like angels and demons and everything were actually like these creatures that came to Earth, were magical beings that represented different things within different faiths and ran off of faithful energy. So like they gained their power based on their fear or the faith of their followers.
Okay.
And so it was the job of the Shoot First team to stop them.
Not to keep them in balance?
Right. To get them because they were upsetting the balance of the world. Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, in a way, this is kind of what these Devler guys are kind of tasked to do. Like, you know, hell's spilling over into Earth. You guys are the first line of defense against...
First line of defense. Go into hell now. Yeah.
You take the fight to them.
Yeah.
Okay.
What else are you gonna do?
I don't know.
You gonna sit back?
Yeah.
Probably.
Wait for hell to come to you.
Well, yeah, a little bit.
I guess it speaks to like what kind of person you are.
I thought the motivation, like the real estate motivation, was solid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my only real disappointment was like, it felt like the way it was set up in the first issue was almost that they were like a Voltron. They keep referring to the main guy as like the head of the demon. So I was like, oh, that'd be so awesome if they
form
that. Like one of my favorite books of all time is from the New Universe.
Okay.
Marvel's failed new
Kickers
universe.
Is that your favorite?
Psi-Force.
No,
well, DP7 is my favorite, but Psi-Force was really good. And it's all these different psychics, but they can combine their powers and form the Psi-Hawk, who is basically their psychic Voltron.
I mean, it's only the second issue, Chris.
I know.
Still.
I'm hopeful. Like,
why doesn't your Twitter description call you the psychic Voltron?
I ran out of room.
Okay.
I have to keep editing.
Yeah. Man, now I'm going to be disappointed if there's never...
Guys, this is what fan fiction's for.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
That's why the internet invented it.
Huh.
But yeah, I like the, like, that it is very straightforward, like, in terms of, like, heaven and hell sort of stuff.
Yeah, there was they weren't mincing any words
yeah.
about that.
Like, because, I mean, like, I know Josh does another book for Oni called The Life After.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But it's also a book about purgatory, which I do a book about purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
And we're both doing, like, very non-traditional depictions of the afterlife.
Right.
So.
Yeah, you forgot to mention Dead Letters.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Oh, gosh, you're writing so many comics.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to remember them.
Let me undo the scroll here.
Yeah, you just edit. I'll just say Dead Letters.
Well, purgatory in terms of like a concept is very popular because it is by definition like the kind of the in-between space. So I think as literary people tend to then what's my version of it?
So I have a question for you, Mr. Religious Scholar Myers.
Mm-hmm.
Is purgatory, or actually Chris probably knows this, assuming you did some research.
Sure.
Right? Is purgatory also a predominantly Judeo-Christian concept?
There are variations on it. Like,
I mean, it's Old Testament.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what... I'm looking for something outside of that box.
Yeah, there are mm-hmm. other religions that have the concept of, like, the waiting place that you go to.
Okay,
like
Elysian
yeah.
Fields style.
Yeah.
No, wait, that's the good one. What is purgatory in... God. See, this is the stuff that I used to actually know.
It's the Colosseum, right?
Funny. I wish that people could see the expression on your face when you do that to me, because it's priceless.
Yeah, I don't like revealing this much to you, though. That's why I don't like doing it face-to-face.
I know. We can never do this again until next
mm-hmm.
time.
Okay. Oh, you just have to drive up. I'm never coming to you. I'm putting that
yeah,
out there.
Yeah, that's fine. Even though your brother lives, like, across the bay from me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'll record from his house.
That would be awesome.
Just show up.
Sure.
I'm here. We can't actually be around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's all good.
Mm.
Anything else from the Devlers?
No, we can talk about other books.
We only have one other book.
Then let's just talk about that one.
Okay.
All right.
Hey, comics therapists. This is John Cole on Twitter @J_Cole. So your comment about comic book gods, and I have to say, seeing as how we're talking about comics, I really don't want any gods. I kind of prefer to be my own god, like Dr. Manhattan. That sounds about the right speech for me. Thanks a lot, guys. Bye-bye.
Second book this week is Clive Barker's Next Testament number 12, written by Clive Barker and Mark Miller, with art by Hemi Zhang.
I gave you pronunciation. Read my pronunciation.
Hai Mi Zhang, lettering by Steve Wands. Next Testament is published by Boom Studios.
It's like he didn't even read it. I put it there in capital letters for you.
Yeah, but it's in parentheses. That means I'm not supposed to read it.
But then when you read it wrong.
Because I read everything outside of it. Why are we arguing about this? There's plenty more to argue about.
I tried really hard to like make that gesture for you.
I know, but why are you screwing up with a model that works?
Because I decided that maybe it was really obnoxious to intentionally mispronounce people's names.
I'm not intentionally mispronouncing their names. I'm intentionally reading them the way I know how to read them.
Well, I was trying to make you a better person.
Well, please don't.
Clearly. So this is the final book in this... can we call it a mini-series if there's 12?
Maxi-series. Yeah.
Oh, God. Whatever.
Do you even read comic books?
How many minutes did it take you before you said that?
26.
I mean,
not bad.
While we were recording, because you certainly have said it.
I like to remind
since
you.
I got here.
If you're coming here, I'm going to remind you that often.
Right. It's a lie, dear internet, by the way.
That you read comic books?
That I don't.
Oh, okay.
I hate you.
Mm-hmm.
Final issue?
Yes.
And I wasn't reading this. Thank you for suggesting it.
Yeah,
sincerely.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I find, a really interesting take on the Old Testament role of God. He's kind of a dick if you haven't read the Old Testament. And it turns out, if you plop him down in modern day, he's even more so.
Mm-hmm.
So we have his reemergence and the family sort of responsible for that. And, you know, then everything goes to hell.
Well, yeah, where hell comes to earth, I guess.
Right. That's my favorite metaphor. I think the...
It's the through line.
I think the juxtaposition of Old Testament God and Satan as having been morphed into a single quote-unquote character in the Bible is fucking spectacular. If that's not a new concept, it was totally new to me, and I think it's really, really interesting.
Yeah, and if you start thinking biblically of how the New Testament versus the Old Testament, I mean, that, you know, that is the whole thing, that Christ the Redeemer coming back and freeing the world from this wrathful, vengeful God that's been torturing
the world. When you then drop him down in, like, today's world, and he's, like, a really kind of terrible, I mean, I know he's not a person, but, like, the Satan characteristics are as strong, if not stronger, than the God characteristics. I think that that's really, really interesting.
I think, if anything, he is the character of God is the perfect representation of what the average person would be like, given omnipotent powers.
God, that's so depressing.
I mean, look at the world this week.
I know, for real. Really, really
disappointed. But the redeemers who defeat him are those unburdened by the desires, like the, you know, the carnality of their brother.
Right.
You know, they're the New Testament gods.
Sure.
He's the Old Testament God. But together, they're the yin and the yang that created the universe.
Or at least the earth.
Yeah, well, sure.
Or at least the people on the earth.
The realm of creation within this world.
Right.
However we're allowed to perceive it.
Huh.
But they also, the New Testament gods, just like the Christ figure realizes, like, you are our creations, we are flawed, therefore they can be nothing but flawed. I like that absolution.
Is it a new concept? Like, have you guys...
That's the whole New Testament's about.
No. I'm talking about, like, this...
The multifaceted God, too?
Yeah. Like, I guess the idea that role of God and Satan is actually from a single being.
No, I don't think... I hadn't ever come across that.
I can't think of, at least in fiction.
It would probably have to have been in fiction.
Although, if you think about it metaphorically in terms of, like, human nature and that sort of thing, like, God and Satan are very, they could be absolutely the same. It's the struggle within all of us.
Have either of you read The Mysterious Stranger?
Mm-hmm.
Mark Twain?
No.
Okay, so first of all, you should both read that. All right. And
who does the art?
Here is a little gimme for you if you don't actually want to read it. Do you remember the Claymation Mark Twain special like when we were kids?
Maybe.
If I find it for you later, you're going to either...
There's a terrifying scene in that.
Yes. Okay, tell me about it, because you're probably thinking of the one that I'm mentioning.
I can't remember the details of it. I just remember that it is horrifying.
Like, it's with the fucking mask?
Yeah?
That's the Mysterious Stranger.
Yeah, okay.
And the Mysterious Stranger is Satan, but has this kind of, like, approachable, godlike... Like, I'm not going to... I guess it's Satan as a non-demonic version.
Mm-hmm.
So you are drawn in by the, like, the banter. The approach is more pleasant. You maybe aren't tipped off immediately that everything is going to just be terrible because it's really scary. And the part of... And it's claymation in this...
Isn't in, like, the old, like, the style of, like, the... Like the Christmas claymations?
No, it's better than that because it's newer.
Okay.
It's similar to, like, Nick Park, you know.
Like a Wallace and Gromit kind of thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's actually earlier than that.
Okay.
And it's unrelated, as far as I'm aware, like, to his studio.
We'll find it on YouTube. And
yes,
it.
It's amazing. But The Mysterious Stranger, the way that story is portrayed in that, which is such a bizarre choice to include in this, like, children's Mark Twain special... That is otherwise full of, like, Becky Thatcher and, you know, Tom Sawyer and the celebrating jumping frog from Calaveras County and, you know, whatever. He's got this mask that he holds over a non-head. And the mask contorts. And there's a point where... And he tells the story of Adam and Eve. And, like, everything is really fucking dark and dire for a while. And the mask contorts and makes this face, which I'm just assuming is what you're remembering. Because, like, everybody...
Yeah, I remember the mask.
It's just burned into your skin. It is absolutely terrifying. It really is. But also kind of amazing. But that is an example of that, like, dual God-Satan kind of vibe that I got from Wick that is the reason why this book was so appealing. Like, otherwise...
It also gets you, like, raises the... Like, a lot of the reading for me just puts that, you know, gets the hairs on the back of your neck standing up kind of thing of this sort of loss of all... There's nothing you could do, in a way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that stripping away of humanity's power.
Sure. Sure, like a really bad disaster movie.
But even worse than that. Like,
yeah, because it's like on a greater scale, but still.
But at the same time, like the story of the couple is that's the hero's journey, you know, the redemption of like calling forth and saving humanity. It's, you know, it's all the Noah and all those, the typical kind of, you know, saving the earth in the last seconds,
right,
kind of thing.
Noah specifically called out by Wick as not because the people were doing anything bad. He just kind of wanted to see what would happen, and he just fucking flooded
That's the worst part of it, though, is like punishment with reason is something you can understand. Punishment without reason is the scary part. You know, it's like living with an abuser that you have no idea what their triggers are. Like, you know, you're paralyzed because you don't know what will set something off. And even being paralyzed, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, those crowd scenes caused me a bit of anxiety, no lie.
The worst part with me was when the planes couldn't fly anymore.
When they just dropped them?
Yeah,
he said,
flight, I don't like that you guys could fly. No more flight. Like, that kind of thing, like the, like, you know, I am a scientific, I am a biblical scholar, but I'm also a scientific scholar as well. That's a thing, right?
Let's don't clash.
When you make it such a compelling argument.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Hey, the idea of supernatural forces changing the laws of physics by will
freaks you out.
Freaks me out.
Well, now we found your trigger.
Sure.
You just have to make it happen.
You just have to change the laws of physics in my presence on a global or universal scale.
I have a question about the final issue, which...
You don't like happy endings?
We're just going to just completely
we already talked about it.
Spoil it.
It's the final issue.
Fine.
That's fine. He had a chance. We told him. He's here. He's here.
Your fault, man.
Look.
Oh, no. I knew what I was doing. I tried to read them all. I could not make it happen.
In a purely biblical sort of sense, you have free will and you're a hero of your own accord.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's my question. At the very end, it's sort of... It's not even implied. It's just stated that they can't undo any of the things that Wick, except it's not dark anymore.
Yeah, it's somewhat,
it wasn't dark. It was,
I think
it was not dark.
It became light they left.
Nope,
though, right?
It was, when they left what?
When the gods left.
I don't know. That wasn't shown.
So, just...
I was
then
just rattling off in my head
there,
things. I could, but I was interested because it was such a very specific line. It's like, we can't, going back to your like physics thing, we can't undo the things that he put in place. So my assumption meant was that meant like the technology
right.
was affected. The
Which you see.
Planes
yeah.
were affected. I don't know if... plague of locusts is self-perpetuating, but like certainly all of the cities that he destroyed aren't gonna be like
rebuilt,
think there was any
yes.
sort of assumption that those
yeah
things were rebuilt, but the lack of darkness, you know, that's the only thing I noticed at the end that was maybe a little like
well,
okay, it's cool.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise the people couldn't survive.
Well,
I mean, you gotta have a happy ending somewhere, you know. Some stuff. There's a stretching
fine.
Somewhere.
Fine.
You gotta be able to go across.
You do.
Mm-hmm.
Until the locusts come, because then that's terrible.
Sure. I mean, locusts happen.
Such a bummer. Yeah. Everything I know about locust swarms, I learned from Little House on the Prairie. There's a lot of stuff that I learned from that series when I was a kid that turns out is not true at all.
Are there locusts on that
show? Yeah, there's like, well, the books. I didn't ever see the show.
Oh, okay.
But definitely more than once, their crops are affected by like grasshoppers. Also, there's like a whole thing with leeches that I learned was not true. And
everything I learned about leeches, I learned from Stand By Me.
Oh, man. Yes. Also,
vomit.
Yeah. Right. Eating contest and
mm-hmm.
everything. Yeah.
Yep.
Huh.
Well, we learned a lot this
Did
week.
We? Did we learn a lot?
No.
No. Do we ever?
No.
Oh, you know what we learned a lot during? When we talked to Chris Ross.
We did learn a lot.
We learned a lot about digital publishing, and we learned a lot about the production side of making comics, which was really
right, but
fucking fascinating.
It's actually a lot more interesting than you just made it sound.
I think that kind of stuff is great.
Yeah, but you're a weird nerd in that way, and most
really?
People don't think they would want to
really?
Learn about that kind of thing.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
I think people should want to know.
Thank you.
I mean, I agree that like most people just blow that stuff off. Like
you can agree with that as long as you don't agree that I'm a weird nerd.
I mean, no weirder than us.
Thanks.
Like,
thank you.
I mean, you're a weird nerd too.
Well, yeah, but I get paid to be a weird nerd,
mm-hmm.
like, so it works for me. Like it is affording my lifestyle.
That's
I'm cool
right.
with that.
The kind of lifestyle that lets you just drive to Eugene on a Thursday to record
yeah,
a podcast.
Like I used to be a weird nerd,
right
like. And nobody paid me shit. Like, and now, like, yeah.
You're living a dream.
Yeah, I'm making money off
it. With,
so.
Like, you know, some Eisner nominations in your back
yeah,
pocket.
Yeah, too.
Right? You wore a suit, sort of.
I did. I wore the top half of the
yeah.
suit. That's more than I ever wear. Like, this is the first time I've been spotted in public.
You
not
did,
in a hoodie.
You like. Were wearing pants. Just, I want to make it clear.
Well, yeah.
Right. Well, you.
I'm not going to the Eisners without pants.
Well, but you said just the top half, so I didn't want
the top
to
half was fancy, and the bottom half is like, these are actually the pants I wore to the Eisners.
Oh,
so
excellent.
This is basically what I wore to the Eisners,
except
from the top up. It was much fancier. And now I don't have to do that again unless I get, you know, invited to the Eisners again or someone dies. Like,
oh.
or
either way. Or both.
Yeah.
It's probably not like a joint occasion.
I mean, space and rental, you know, places to rent. Like, it's getting more
yeah.
expensive.
I think we're going to start seeing more of those in the future.
Oh,
like,
goodness.
The in memorandum, you know, combined with the.
In memorandum,
right?
What?
Random.
Whatever. And what
how
is
much have you had to drink?
It's really hot in this room. Like, I am not.
Why did you think whiskey was a good idea in this hot ass room?
Well, let's end this for our sake as well as everybody else's.
Yes.
But we'll cut to our sweet interview, which is super exciting, and everyone's gonna be like, "Whoa!" with Chris Ross from.
Now
Top
you oversold
Shelf.
It.
Oh, come on. It's good times.
It's halfway in between the first one and that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is still pretty good.
Thank you to Chris Sabella for hanging out with us today.
Thanks for having me.
What?
Thank you for having me. What? That's only polite.
We're
very, very polite.
We're stepping into delirium.
We are. Thanks, Myers, for letting us come to your house.
Sure. Let's never do it again.
Until
Woo!
Next time.
All right.
Cheers.
Bye.
Peace out.
Hi, Comics Therapy. It's Ashley Robinson, co-host of the Geek History Lesson podcast, calling at Ashley B. Robinson on the Twitter. And my nerd confession about which comic deity I would like to be in charge of me, I think the pretty obvious answer as a 20-something female has to be Loki, so that way I can already get away with what I'm doing. And maybe, just maybe, if he got bored, then I could go and cross some shit and then Marvel you. Sorry for cursing. And that would be the most fun ever. I don't see how there's any other greater choice than that. You can basically chill with what you're doing. You can maybe cause some mischief. And maybe you'll get to kiss someone else like Tom Hiddleston. I'm just saying, that would be like the best ever. So yeah, there's my answer. Loki.
This week on The Couch, we welcome Eisner-nominated Chris Ross, director of digital publishing for Top Shelf Productions. He's also their lead designer, and you've seen his work on Nate Powell, John Lewis and Andrew Iden's March, Mark Russell and Shannon Wheeler's God is Disappointed in You, Jeff Lemire's Lost Dogs and Underwater Welter, and of course, Ed Pisker's WYSIWYG, nominated for Best Publication Design, probably for its sweet dimensional cover hotness. We're going to talk about what exactly all of this production stuff means and some good old-fashioned digital versus print ideas. So thanks for hanging out with us today, Chris.
Thank you for having me. That was such a lovely introduction. I get
Aww.
Goosebumps just like wow.
Awesome.
Was it actually correct, too? Because
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
bonus
no,
points,
it was,
then.
It was like, wow, I have such an awesome resume.
Well, we lay it out like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, let's start with some context before we kind of go deeper. You know, we've talked with writers, artists, editors, letterers, designers, publishers. They've all been on the show before, and it gives our listeners, you know, kind of insight into the whole world of the industry and what goes into putting a comic into their hands. Can you kind of talk us through what you do for Top Shelf on a day-to-day basis?
Okay. On a day-to-day basis, I do kind of all of the making of a book, as opposed to editing it or creating it or marketing it or publicizing it. Mm-hmm. So I get to take all of the files, work with the artist to make sure that they're print ready, work with them to design a cover, get all of the files laid out and in design and that they're, you know, pre-pressed and ready to go, and then work with the printers to get them made. And then on the digital side, prep all of the digital stuff for our digital partners.
What is the digital stuff? Because a lot of people don't actually understand what that means.
So, yeah. Basically, what I do is I'll prepare all of the files for our digital partners, like getting PDFs together for Comixology or Barnes & Noble or Kobo, Combo Bundle, all of those folks, and get those, fill out all of the metadata stuff, get it all ready for those places, and then create, for other vendors, I'll create EPUB files and CBZ files, and then populate all of those vendors with those files, like, for instance, Apple and Google require EPUB documents. Mm. So I'll build those out. And then for CBZs and PDFs and other awesome acronym file names for DRM free on our website.
Right.
Has it gotten a little easier, or has it gotten more complicated as digital has, you know, become more and more in the comics marketplace? Like I can't tell if it's still the wild, wild west of comics publishing, or if it's like somewhat getting streamlined now.
You know, the image that I get is that it's stopped becoming the wild west and has entered that weird period of like Standard Oil, if that makes any sense.
That's a great analogy.
You're starting to get titans.
Yeah.
You're starting to battle out over what the landscape is going to look like.
Mm.
Tim O'Reilly of O'Reilly Publishing put it really, really well in that he envisioned these columns, right? And Apple is a column, and Google is a column, and Amazon is a column.
Mm.
And all of their devices and formats and operability are fine so long as you stay within that column. Sometimes these columns can interact, right? So, like, in the App Store, in the Apple column, on the vertical there, you can have an Amazon reader or a Google reader, but it's very difficult to buy anything in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a Kindle Fire phone, like, you can have access to some of the Apple stuff, you know, the Apple readers, the kind of few and far between, but like some of the cloud features are industry standard compliance stuff, so you can kind of reach across that way. But for the most part, it kind of forces you into these silos, these columns. So that's where I think the landscape is some of the people figuring out, just in the kind of general trade ebook way, how do these things interoperate? And then with comics, it gets really, really complicated.
Hmm.
As opposed to with books?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Books or movies or films or TV shows, yeah. Any other sort of consumable media.
Is it more complicated with comics because everyone is figuring it out for themselves? I mean, like, where does that disconnect come from in comics specifically?
I think I have some sneaky suspicions, and I don't know if I'm right, but I think a lot of that has to do with guided view. You know what, that Comixology and John Roberts and David Steinberger figured out how the best way of viewing comics on a small device, on a 5-inch screen,
right?
On the phone. Tablets, you know, it can have some kind of interoperability. I have found some kind of, intercompany, good, healthy arguments about what's the best way to view a comic on a tablet. Like, I like iBooks and look reading a comic full screen.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Walton, who's our fabulous publicist, likes the guided view more than he likes the looking at page. I mean, it also depends on the book, but the thing that has defined how ebooks function for comics has been guided view.
That's really interesting because I think you're right that it's overwhelmingly for people who are reading comics on their phones, which, mm-hmm. gosh, I actually hope is not a huge number of people. I enjoy guided view and I have absolutely read comics on my phone at desperate times, but by and large, my preference would always be to have the full page.
Yeah, like on a computer screen?
Or on a tablet, or, you know, in a print version. So the fact that you're saying that guided view as a kind of industry influencer would be one of the things affecting, I guess, more than what I would have considered its like fair share of influence.
Mm-hmm.
I really hope that most people who are reading comics digitally are not reading them on their phones.
No, it's not most, but it's very close.
Wow.
Wow. But we also consider that, not all folks who read comics are comic book readers, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do it kind of in a kind of passive way. Maybe they're not fans. Maybe they just liked, they saw the newest Avengers movie or Guardians of the Galaxy or what have you, and they just want to pick up a comic here or there. You know, they've heard about March and wanted to pick it up,
mm-hmm.
you know, and take a look at it, but they don't really have a tablet and
they
sure. aren't really comfortable reading on a computer screen, but they do have a phone.
Right, and you don't want to alienate them because it's easy,
exactly.
Or it should be easy.
I think most folks are trained, and I know this sounds like a horrible term, but most folks are trained and are comfortable with purchasing stuff on their smartphone now.
Yeah.
Especially within the price point of comics.
Mm-hmm.
Anything more than, say, $6, $7, and it kind of gets a little hinky, but, you know, a dollar or two for a comic. Yeah, you know, people will buy that on a smartphone. And the easiest way to read comics on a smartphone is through that guided view or guided view type interface.
So is that $6-$7 price point where it crosses over? Is that where somebody's mind goes, well, if I'm going to spend that much money, I want to have some, like I want to hold something for that much?
It gets into that area. Mm. Yeah. If I'm going to be spending $10, how much is the book and can I get a group deal? Right.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to buy From Hell by Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell, which is a 600-page book, and retails for $35. For an additional $3 or $4, you can get the digital version,
mm-hmm.
and that becomes more interesting because you can have the best of both of these things. You know, you can carry around a 600 or 700-page book when you're out and about. You know, you're waiting on the bus.
Right.
Standing in line and you just want to read 3 or 4 pages, but it's not really a good idea to, fold it. It's a huge book. You can't really keep it in your pocket.
Right.
Or if you have a copy of Saga #3, but you don't really want to fold that and keep it in your back pocket. You want to keep it bagged and boarded.
Unless you're me. Then you're like, whatever, it's fine.
Well, you buy 3 copies, right? One is for...
Now you're talking my language.
Right.
Yeah, keep it in the door of your car, and then the third one you never, ever touch or look at, and then the third one is your backup.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That goes in the bunker.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, in the bunker. We're going to talk more about digital and print, but let me step back a little bit about... and let's look at publishing as a whole. Because I'm curious for you, like, why... Why publishing? Why, and like, why comics? Because from the outside, we read a lot about the challenges and the struggles and like way less, unfortunately, about the successes. Yet they're obviously there. So like, what is it about the job for you personally?
You know, I actually had a really great conversation with David Steinberger down in San Diego about that very thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what he had just, we were talking a little bit about, you know, working with Amazon and how that was going and some of the exciting things that are in store for them. And it was, you know, the long and short of it was like, what do you like doing? Because honestly, that's what it really comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, for publishing, you know, I think we are fans of the things we like, right? Right. We can be fans of Saga, of Image, of DC, of all of these books that we really, really love, you know, that we're really, really into, that we want, we really appreciate or love the creators, right? Like
mm-hmm.
big fans of Jeff Lemire or Rob Venditti or Van Jensen or Kelly Sue DeConnick or Matt Fraction. But what I love about my job is that I can be fans of my friends, right? That these wonderful creators are like friends of yours,
mm-hmm.
right? And that is a privilege. That's why I like getting up in the morning.
Does that make it hard when you have that personal relationship sometimes to keep objectivity though?
Oh no, not at all. especially when you're designing their book.
Uh-huh.
Right. I a lot of designers like to design in a vacuum, and a lot of publishing companies in the general trade tend to say to authors, "Hey, this is what your book is going to look like, and you have no say in it." You know, especially first time authors.
Mm-hmm.
And they can hate, I don't know how many authors I've met where they've absolutely hated the design of their book.
Right.
And it's not until like the third or fourth printing, if it makes it that way, that they start having some influence on that. But I don't think March Book One could have looked the way that it looks without the friendly comedy and friendship with Nate and Andrew and the congressman.
Is it beneficial to have that personal relationship? Like it gives you a different layer of honesty where you can kind of strip away the, I guess, the professional aspect of it, where you don't have to, like, I guess, kind of step on eggshells when it comes to the creative process?
No, I think not necessarily. It's definitely dirty, but it doesn't necessarily have to be unprofessional. It kind of reminds me of therapy. Right,
mm-hmm.
is you step on eggshells,
right.
and it's still a professional job.
Right.
But there's a layer of trust to that, too.
Sure, oh, certainly.
I think the relationship that you're referring to, it just comes with the familiarity. I mean, that's true with sort of any kind of collaboration, right?
Yeah, but there's also an ability to say, like, trust, I think,
right.
maybe is I'll give you an example. One of the issues that we had with March is if you look at that book, the first that has the top of it is our marching feet, and that comes from a quote from Dr. King, and the bottom has the congressman at a table. And originally that image at the bottom was of a trooper on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. This was originally when March was going to be one book. And when we were looking at it, we realized that there wasn't any folks of color on the front of the cover.
Mm.
Right? And that was a big problem. You know, we were looking at it and, like, this is a story about the civil rights movement, and there aren't any folks, no discernible faces on the cover,
mm-hmm.
especially not black folks. So, you know, that took a lot of kind of trust to be able to go back and talk about it amongst all of the stakeholders that we need to rethink this book design.
Right.
And have honest conversation, even if it steps on people's toes and maybe isn't sometimes the road to kind of understanding is you kind of have to just phrase something and hope it doesn't step on very many toes, and
mm-hmm.
be prepared to revise and edit your, you know, being able to talk about things that are really uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
and to find some kind of ultimate truth at the end of it. And I think that was what we came to with this cover.
Well, especially when it comes to a book like that, or anything, when you're putting together it's an art, it is a cover, but it's an art piece too, that you're trusting whoever you've hired for to make that cover for you to make it, you know, like is there, I guess the question from a design standpoint is, do they initially start out, like, say, March in that respect? Mm-hmm. Is it like, here's what we would like the cover to be, or is it here's, go ahead and make the cover for us?
It depends. A lot of times I get the my charge is, hey, go make a cover, and when it's beautiful, I want to see it, and I will say yes or no.
Uh-huh.
Right? And that's a really tough place to start.
But who is that coming from? Is that coming from the, like, somebody from Top Shelf, or is that, it's like, hey,
author,
Chris, go make this cover.
Sometimes it's internal.
Okay.
And, there's just not a whole lot of time to write a brief.
Got it.
Right?
Got it.
So the brief, a designer kind of has to be kind of hinging on themselves to decide,
right,
okay, this is what the brief is going to be. This is the this is what the message is going to communicate. And that's just kind of the state of design, right?
Right.
And it's not just Top Shelf. Almost every design job I've had, that was the thing. Make a beautiful cover. That was the design brief.
Yeah.
And essentially, design then is like an expanded version of editorial in that regard.
Exactly. It's this weird. It's like if editorial and marketing had a baby,
mm-hmm.
uh-huh.
and instead of going to college, it went to art school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so with March, I sat down with Nate with his original Ashcan cover. And there was discussion and kind of internal to Top Shelf, and he and Andrew communicate daily. Andrew Iden is the Congressman John Lewis's aide who wrote the script for March with him.
Mm-hmm.
We sat down with both Andrew and Nate, who then reported to the Congressman, like, okay, what is this book going to look like? What is the concept of this book? And part of it was that I wanted it to feel like it came from a place without replicating the aesthetic of the time period, if that makes any sense. Like,
yeah,
this
absolutely.
Book should look like it went through something.
Right, right.
Which
I feel like you primarily communicated with your color choices on the cover.
Mm-hmm. That was one part, was warning, right? It should have an idea of warning behind it,
mm-hmm.
like going from something safe into danger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the congressman's late wife was a librarian. And when I was young, we had a lot of hand-me-down books in the library. They were usually taped together on the spine. So that became a design feature.
Okay.
Right. So that the book itself would kind of resemble books that were handed down from maybe a white school district to a primarily Negro school district in the South.
Got it.
And then I went through and spoke with some of the folks that Andrew recommended about some of the history in the South, and looked at some of the, just looking at artifacts. What do the books look like? What is the aesthetic of the time period?
Mm-hmm.
And this red tape also had really kind of weird, important, symbolic thing, right? Because the congressman, John Lewis will later become a congressman. So red tape is a very, very interesting trope to include.
Mm-hmm.
And so we included that. And then on the back cover is the beautiful painting that Nate did of the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And we realized that if we can make that a triptych for the three volumes, so that the second volume may not necessarily be a bridge, but it'll be something that is really unique, but suggests the continuation of that arc,
mm-hmm.
right? And then the third volume is as that arc comes down. It kind of made me think of that quote from Dr. King about the moral compass of the, or the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an aesthetic that kind of reaches across all of the other books. And then once we've, and it was funny, we actually designed the covers for March book one and two at the same time. And as soon as we finished book one and it was approved, we spent 2 weeks and just knocked out book two. And the conversation around that was with Nate thinking about what are some of the tropes of the time period. One of the big features in book two is the Freedom Riders. So we looked at a lot of the color signage of Greyhound buses.
Yeah.
And thought a lot about the historical significance of the colors for at least the United States of blue and gray.
Mm-hmm.
It has this kind of Civil War sort of connotation or denotation, or, you know, that has kind of an implicit thing there. And if you've ever been to D.C., and looked out over the memorial, from the Lincoln Memorial, it has a completely different kind of valence as you would think, compared to, like, you know, you see a movie like Forrest Gump, or any other time you see footage of the I Have a Dream speech, you have a certain sense of what the space looks like, and we wanted to explore, well, is there a better way of thinking about that space?
Mm-hmm.
And you never really see what this very young African-American leader saw when he just kind of stepped out in front of this in this historic event. Like, what kind of emotions, like, what is he fighting for?
Mm-hmm.
And pair that with the bus that's above it, and, you know, it has this really, really interesting energy when you have it going from on the bottom from right to left, which has a certain kind of connotation, and then from left to right going the other way with a Dutch angle, it kind of throws out a little bit. And
mm-hmm.
then with the back cover, which I don't think we've released yet.
I haven't seen it. Is it?
Yeah.
Can you talk
it's
about
very
it?
Beautiful. It's very beautiful. I've seen it. We've worked on it. I don't think it's been approved yet.
Okay.
Like, all of this, the stakeholders have rubber stamped it in a way, but they don't, like, the concept of it. But it's going to be an image of the so the book two ends, and I don't know if I want to spoil it, with a very historic event that follows the March on Washington. I have to check and see if Andrew has actually talked about this yet. With the church bombing where the four little girls were killed. And so it's taken from, the back cover is actually an image of the 16th Street Baptist Church. So with the church that was bombed.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
So it's from one of the stained glass panels.
So that's where the arch will continue from that image?
Yeah, that's the apex of the arch.
And yeah.
And the third book, we're still kind of noodling on it a little bit. That might change. That might change.
Got it.
So, and then it's weird that the way that Nate has cropped the image that he has, it actually, the image has Christ the Redeemer on it, but the panel where Christ's face is has been blown out, right? The bomb actually did this really, really kind of weird symbolic damage to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't see his face.
Wow.
And the way that Nate has cropped the image, it's on like another Dutch angle that's kind of the mirror image of what the front cover looks like. And then there's four breaks in the stained glass. So, you know, we put some light streaming in from it, and so there's a certain symbolism there too. Poor little girls, and then the four panels that got blown out. So it's stuff like that where when you work with somebody that you trust, you know, you end up pushing each other a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it just becomes this, like a collaboration. So
with March, really, though, because that whole book was very collaborative just because of the work that Nate was doing with the congressman. I'm curious if that is different for you when you're working with somebody like Ed Pisker or Jeff Lemire, because they, as creators themselves, are used to doing so much on their own.
Yeah.
Does it change your approach from the production side? Because you have to be aware of the marketing part of the design as well.
So I'll look, in addition to those two examples, I'll throw in a third.
Okay.
So with the work done on Underwater Welder, that mm-hmm. was almost complete. Like, Jeff had a vision of what the cover wanted to look like. It was basically laid out that way. He had powwowed a little bit with Matt Kent
mm-hmm.
On some of the features of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the only stuff that I did was kind of give it a better kind of type treatment and rethought some stuff. And it was more production design. It was making this concept better, you know, a little bit more, just kind of clarifying it. And then doing interior design, which is kind of its own device.
Right.
Versus Lost Dogs, which was like that one. Jeff actually came to me outside of Top Shelf. He had seen the lettering and design work that I had done on Ludovic Debaume's Lucille.
Hmm.
And Lee Walton put me in touch with him, and he ended up hiring me to kind of rethink Lost Dogs. You all know the story behind that?
No. I don't.
Okay, so Lost Dogs was Jeff Lemire's first book, and it was an 11 by 8, and it started out as a 24-hour comic book day deal.
Oh, I didn't know that was the origination of it.
Yeah, or a 48-hour comic book day thing,
mm-hmm.
and it was the first thing that he had done. He had done a couple other smaller comics that will never ever see the light of day, but this was the first one that he really, really kind of sank his teeth into, and he kind of pushed it to the end, and he received a Xerox grant to print it. It was very, very roughly lettered because it was a 24-hour a day, or, you know, this limited comic, and the printer didn't really do a great job on the color. It was a two-color deal.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see Lost Dogs, the washes that Jeff uses have a blue quality to them. So they form really, really interesting colors when mixed with the red ink that he has.
Right.
So whatever it was going to do, whatever the extent was going to be, the whether it was going to be two-color or whatever, it had to be four-color. Because in order to get some of these washes to pop, you have to have four colors going on. It was just
otherwise you miss the depth and the right.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the trapping would be weird because it's a flat color and it doesn't mix very well with the inks, and it just is, it would be a hassle to go through and kind of separate those out. And then he asked me to, this was kind of funny, to take it from an 8x10 or 8, I think it was 8x11, 10.5. It was an odd letter cover. I think it was more like a metric cover.
Hmm.
Take that and bring it down to 6.5x9. So doing a reduction,
mm-hmm.
and then relettering the whole thing, as well as redoing the cover. And so that something like that was a very, very involved deal.
Right.
And so it ended up being, do you have that book in front of you?
I have it in the other room. Okay. Yeah, I really want to go grab it right now so I can look at it, but.
Yeah. So if you look at that book, it's a matte black with a spot gloss,
uh-huh.
a red and white with an image taken out and put it on the bottom left. And if you look on the back, it's actually just a motif of the main character's shirt that he's wearing. It's like a sailor shirt. The thing I love about this book is that while it's very, very stark, and you immediately pick it up and look at it because it has that white and red thing, that kind of candy cane look, against this matte black. What's nice about the matte black is that it ages really, really well, right? It ends up getting kind of bruised, which is it was just like a thing that was in the back of my mind about how this thing ages. But it should kind of show its time a little bit. It was just was a neat little thing that we had figured out to how to make this thing that's black actually be come across and communicate kind of bruise and aging and space.
It's so interesting to hear you say that that would be a quality you would aspire to, because so often when, and I understand this is a trade as opposed to a floppy, but like we talk, Aaron and I talk so much about like the artifact quality of comics, and so something being well loved as a desirable state is something that I think is awesome, but I think is occasionally counter to the way that a lot of people approach comics as a medium, because it's looked at as a collectible. And so when you are influenced by that bruised state from an aesthetic standpoint, I find that like really appealing. I think that's really awesome.
Yeah, I like books should be read. Like comic books are a different sort of thing, right? But I'm gonna put a pin in that for a second. But books have a different life, right?
Right.
They should be open. They should be handled. They should be stored vertically. They should be taken down and read. Their spines need to stay supple in order to last a very, very long time. Like that's a comic books have a different sort of valence around them, single issue, simply because of how they are manufactured and the kind of fetish economy around them.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, it has its own very, very particular quirks.
Right.
And then that's a different kind of beast altogether. When you think about design and stuff like that. So when you get some overlap, especially thinking about a book, like how does this book live? This was one of the important things about March, was that it should be a part of its time period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should come from a place in history, but that shouldn't get in the way of the message, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Unless the message is part of that time period, right? So if you look at book two, instead of being tape, it looks like it survived a bombing, right? It has scorched patina on it. It looks like it was through a fire a little bit. But I don't want the interior pages to be... I want those interior pages to be blackened.
Right? Right.
That gets in the way. The concept and conceit and the gadget or engine that drives the design shouldn't be counter to the message of the book. It should either work in tandem or they should be the same kind of gadget.
Absolutely. Well, so you mentioned this earlier when we were talking about kind of your role at Top Shelf, and let's go back to this digital versus print like quagmire, especially because we're talking about like the physical qualities of some of the book design that you've done, and it's sort of an interesting shift then when you talk about how that translates to digital. But I want to say off the bat that I really appreciate your perspective, that this isn't really a versus argument at all. Top Shelf announced, and you referenced this earlier too, back in the spring, that you guys were doing these bundles for print and digital with a huge discount, and I think that's awesome. I wish more publishers were doing the same and saw that it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. So what's your perspective on what should be happening with the conversation across the industry to move it more from a print versus digital into a discussion that's more productive? Like what needs to happen next?
You know, I think that, I mean, there are a lot of political toes that you can step on, right?
Yeah.
And there are huge landmines that are people's livelihoods. Because anytime you talk about print and digital, what you're really talking about, I think, is these columns, Apple, Google, Amazon versus Diamond, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the stakes. So in somebody in my position, those are difficult waters to kind of navigate.
Is it also beyond just Diamond? Are we also then talking about like brick and mortar stores versus not?
Yes and no. Especially for some reason, it's very difficult to kind of talk about the print side, because not because it's like political in that way, like comic book stores, but you know, comic book stores have a difficult enough time as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they're dealing with a lot of factors, both in terms of economic factors and publisher changes and book changes and inventory, that I can't even fathom.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, my basic philosophy with digital is that, one, they can coexist.
Right.
All data suggests that digital does not influence print sales in the negative. In fact, they help print sales. All of the data suggests that, at least in comic books. It gets a little more gray when you start parsing out the data a little bit. Hardcovers tend to have a harder time when a digital component is involved, and that's in the general trade. The study really hasn't been done in the direct market for comics. So a book that's, for instance, a book that's primarily a hardcover trade, if there's a digital component, sometimes can affect sales, sometimes it doesn't.
Wow.
That's primarily on prose books, and it's mostly like Barnes & Noble.
But got it.
That's usually where the research points, that there's an issue there.
So you can look at that in terms of translation to comics, but acknowledge that we're not talking about comics, that's something that you can observe in publishing, but is, okay, got it.
But it may not necessarily, because the direct market's very quirky.
Right.
Books, like physical, the trade has a different life in comic book stores than it does in Barnes & Noble.
Mm-hmm.
There are different inventory issues. There are different promotional setups. There's a ton of different factors that are part of that. So when you ask, like, is it print versus digital, my basic philosophy is that they should be very intricately tied.
Yeah.
We get the question a lot, where should I buy my digital books? Where can I spend my money so that it benefits the publisher the independent publisher that I support and the author that I love? Which is that question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wherever is going to be most convenient for you and where you want to support it.
Hmm.
If you get all of your books from Amazon and that's just the way that you like consuming your content, and because there are no comic book stores or bookstores of note around you, by all means, that's the way to go. If there's, like we have here in Portland, we're really, really fortunate that we have some amazing comic book stores. And if that's gonna do it for you, go there. Because what you get out of those places are things that you can't get anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Discoverability, right? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, is that something you think of? Maybe not so much on the production side, but maybe just on the business side of the rep. I'm sure it has to be on the minds of all the digital publishers or all the publishers who are pushing towards digital of the discoverability and how it's hard to replicate that in some sort of application.
Yeah. You know, I think I'm going to pick on Amazon a little bit.
Okay. They can take it.
But then I think you should ask me about Amazon, because it's an interesting case study to watch, especially from a publisher perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that Amazon is excellent at logistics, right?
Mm-hmm.
They can get a book from point A to point B if it's a middle list or backlist title. if it's a trade paperback, if you're a Prime member, if all of the stars are perfect, they are perfect at getting a book to you.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you want. Whatever book it is, they can get it to you relatively quickly. And comic book stores can't guarantee that. What comic book stores can do is that they've solved something that I don't think Amazon could ever replicate effectively, and that's discoverability.
Mm.
There are same thing with libraries, right? Libraries are the oldest, best, and in my opinion, most perfect way of discovering books,
mm-hmm.
because you have a lot of folks that completely understand the books that you the book that you're looking for and can help you find books that you would like in more profound ways.
So it's the human factor in both of those cases that you're pointing out.
Exactly.
Can I pose a personal observation? And I'm kind of curious about your thoughts on it. Like, I don't know if it's Amazon's ability to solve that problem, and I think it's already kind of been solved somewhat in the social media space, that social media has really replaced, for especially if it's going to be a digital reader, the library experience or the comic book, you know, store experience, where you can poll the crowd for suggestions.
I'll give you a counter to that, if you don't mind.
Sure. No,
my good friend Matt Roberts is a mutual friend, I think. He does the I Didn't Read It podcast.
Yes.
He'll help out at the Top Shelf booth if I need his help. And his pitch for James Kolchaka's Super Fuckers is absolutely perfect. It's pitch perfect. And it wouldn't work in social media because it involves a very, very crude comment. Right? You kind of have to read the person before you make that sale.
Sure.
And his pitch for Superfucker, and it's fabulous, is he says, you know the Teen Titans?
And they're
like, yeah. He's like, oh, imagine if they were assholes. And it's like that, okay, and you have to read that person in order to be able to do that pitch.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
The perfect pitch for that book. That's not something that can basically be read on social media.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you lose the tone completely.
Yeah, or if you say that I'm looking for that criminal book with all the crimes in it, right? Because
mm-hmm.
you saw it in passing. I mean, there are a lot of books that it could be, or without being able to know it's sex criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or if you go into a bookstore and you say, I'm looking for a book on sex criminals. or you Google that. It has a different sort of valence. Whereas
right.
going into a comic book store, they're instantly going to understand what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think social media really has a hard time, and Amazon has a really hard time with contextualizing.
So does that mean humanity needs to move towards being more robotic, or does the internet need to become more self-aware? Because there's no in between.
Like we all have to be replicants. And
yeah, I mean, you know, if we have a hive mind, then, you know, the Borg never get confused by what, you know, what they're looking for.
Yeah, I think, or we have just one company that we only get one book kind of book from.
Sure, sure. I mean, humans don't really want choice anyway.
I think that's what you get down to isn't necessarily a problem of choice in the kind of matrix sense, but
mm-hmm.
a problem of subtext,
mm-hmm.
right? Knowing exactly what you're looking for without even knowing it yourself.
Right.
And curators are very, very good at that.
Yeah, we don't want, well, here's 50 books that you might enjoy. It's,
mm-hmm.
oh, you got to read this.
Exactly.
But you have to put in, I mean, it goes back to what we were saying earlier about relationships and trust. You have to put in that investment of time to develop that relationship with a person so that they know you well enough that they can make those recommendations. And that's not really what Amazon, despite all of their algorithms to the contrary, they're not foolproof at making those kinds of
of recommendations the same way that like a really great librarian or a really great staff member at a local comic shop is going to be able to do after they've had a chance to get to know you.
Exactly. Exactly. But you know, that interaction may not be for everybody.
Right. You know, right. Like Aaron doesn't really like people. So for example,
yeah, I'm one of those people that doesn't like people either. Like I don't, I used to have a pull box, but the single issue concept of publishing completely baffles me. Right. It's something that I just don't understand.
That's really fascinating because our mutual friend, Matt, mm-hmm. mentioned that you don't actually read comics.
No, I don't.
So did you when joke. You were a kid?
Yeah, no, it's a running joke that we have. Because I work at a really amazing comic book company, and they're like, well, what are you reading? I'm like, I don't like this stuff. My background is in book publishing,
right.
And I do read comics. I just read comics from folks that I know. And
okay.
I know that sounds kind of maybe even more elitist than anything, but it helps me contextualize their work if I know where they're coming from, or that they're friends of mine. Or like right now, my two favorite books, three favorite books right now, are Sex Criminals Saga and Motorcycle Samurai.
Mm.
So, and those are because I absolutely adore Ron Richards, the VP of BizDevs at Image.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's bringing some amazing relationships and helping a lot of wonderful things at Image. And I think they're doing some really, really exciting stuff.
So do you read those digitally, or do you read them?
A mixture of digital and what I can get when I say I'm at cons. But I don't read single issue comics.
I guess it's interesting that you would have like a perspective on making great recommendations based on relationships, but mm-hmm. but then not necessarily follow that yourself.
Yeah, right?
But I think to be fair too, your perspective of comics is different than the person who's
different.
Yeah, it's a different, totally right. different, you know, view of the medium.
Yeah. So the things I look for in a comic are not what fans of comics look for.
Sure.
Right.
Very fair.
So going back to what comics I'm reading right now or the way I'm reading them, funny enough, I actually... The only comic that I've read single issues of in, I think, the last two or three years has been Trillium.
No, oh, really?
By Jeff Lemire, mm-hmm. because I helped make it.
Okay.
So, that's an example. I know it sounds weird, but that's an example of a single issue or comic that I helped with.
I'm curious, too, because the print issues of that have a design aspect to them that's sort of unique. And even in a digital capacity, it's very cumbersome. Like that's a fun one to read. That was fun for me to read in paper mm-hmm. because you flip the pages back and forth, you know, there's constant movement that is kind of a pain to do on a tablet.
Yeah. It was not fun for me to read that one digitally.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's thinking of this as object. And I think it'll be more interesting when you read that in a collected trade,
mm-hmm.
right? Because some of the tropes and design stuff that Jeff is thinking about are centered on single issue comic form.
Right.
Right. And that's
Chris, why don't you tell everybody what you did on that? Because it's actually really fucking cool.
I designed the Adabit language.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah. Jeff came to me because I had lettered Lost Dogs. And he had asked if I would be willing to design this alien language originally. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have to do Klingon. I'm going to have to get an associate's degree in linguistics. down and like, it's going to be the next Klingon. I'm painting myself into a corner. He's like, no, I just basically want you to do a letter for letter version of this language.
He shot down your 2-year proposal of research and design and Rosetta Stone and everything else?
Exactly. He had sent me the email, and I was like, yes. And by the time 2 hours later, I had already figured out what the basic phonetics of their language was going to be. Originally, it was going to be this, like if you look at Sanskrit and Tibetan, it's a stackable language. So mm-hmm. all of the glyphs end up stacking on top of each other. So right. originally, it was going to have that feature to it. You're making it more complicated than it needs to be.
Well, that should be part. That should be part of the collected edition. The whole what could have been with the with the language.
Yeah, I think it was only going to be 7 to 13 issues at the time. He's like, this is not going to be an ongoing thing. So he was very nice about it, and we peeled that off.
You'd already registered the domain names and put up the class schedule for people who wanted to.
And I've developed their own mathematics. Like the rudimentary was going to be a base 3 mathematic language.
And, oh, awesome.
Yeah.
And really, you can't just show people what their modern language is. You have to start back, you know, in a medieval kind of form and show how it evolves based upon, right. you know, socioeconomic influences throughout time. Like, you got to do the work.
It actually begins as Mayan. So if you look at some of Mayan scripts,
mm-hmm.
a lot of those glyphs appear in the pictograms of Mayan glyphs.
Mm-hmm.
Right on.
An example, I think, is the A. I don't have the thing in front of me, but it looks like a frowny face.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually taken directly from a glyph. Mm. A glyph.
Oh, very cool.
Then that and all of the glyphs had to be less than three movements, right? So
mm-hmm.
Each stroke had to be less than three, thinking that they were going to be drawing them in dirt because they don't have a paper
mm-hmm.
sort of, but they also have a written language, but it's all done in dirt. Like if you look at the issue 1, they're drawing stuff on the ground. So anyway.
This could have been your Esperanto, and Jeff Lemire just took it away from you.
Next time. I don't know. I'm hoping he'll pick me for Descender.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, let's wrap this up with some lighthearted talk about scotch. What okay. do you drink regularly, and how? And then okay. what's your favorite for special occasions?
So my in-laws got me this for my birthday last year, got me this. Like 20-year Glenfiddich single malt that was aged in a wine barrel called Solara.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh my gosh, it's so amazing! Like you drink it and you see old gods and kings. It's beautiful. my wife was kind of a whiskey drinker, and I think we got into a little bit of a fight about how wonderful that scotch is and how who loved it more.
Oh, excellent. So is that a special occasion one, or is that now just become like your regular go-to?
Oh, it's in the archives. I drank it like within 2 or 3 weeks of me getting it. I'm not a patient man.
I like that as a terminology, like as a turn of phrase for alcoholism. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just not patient.
Yeah, I'm totally impatient.
Uh-huh.
That was my primary scotch. My utility brown liquor is just normal Jameson.
Excellent.
But for the most part, I drink wine. I'm a big wine drinker.
Oh, fantastic. Any local or I guess Oregon-specific vineyards that are your favorites?
Why, yes, I have opinions about wines in Oregon.
Do you?
Yeah. I don't read single-issue comics, but I have opinions about vineyards.
Don't read single issues, but you do drink single malts.
Exactly. There's a one out in Forest Grove called David Hill,
mm-hmm.
And they have some of the oldest Pinot Noir vines in the Willamette Valley. Well, Willamette Valley is really, really well known for their Pinot grapes.
Mm-hmm.
you've seen the movie Sideways. They talk a little bit about how Pinot grapes are very, very temperamental because of humidity and et cetera, et cetera. Well, those conditions that are in Northern California are very, very are replicated very closely with some of the stuff in the hills around the Willamette Valley. So almost all of the grapes grown there are Pinot grapes. Some of them are really, really good, and other ones are really, really bad, but it takes a little while for Pinot to establish. Mm. So David Hill out in Forest Grove has amazing Pinot Noir.
Excellent.
And then down south in Rogue Valley, Ashland, Medford, they grow a little bit hardier stuff, like Tempranillos and stuff. Mm-hmm. So a lot more Spanish-type varietals are grown down there because it's a little bit warmer and humidity is a little bit different. So you end up getting a lot of really, really amazing blends. One of the problems, especially with wine up here, is that you get a lot of bottle variation from vintage to vintage.
Mm-hmm.
So, or from year to year, and from what they call horizontal tastings, like all of the Pinot Noirs from different vineyards will kind of be a little wonkity, and then they'll be wonkity in a vertical from, you know, 2009, 10, 11, and 12. But for the most part, they're really, really amazing at David Hill.
Hmm. So you prefer red, is my guess.
For the most part. My wife really, really likes white. And what's nice about Willamette Valley is that they're really similar to some of the German areas where they grow, like the Verstraminer and some Rieslings. And they grow really, really well here, too. So I tend to like drier Gewürztraminer.
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah. Gewürztraminer, have you ever had a Riesling?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so Gewürztraminer is a little, for lack of a better term, it's a little bit more full, right? It has a little bit more complexity to it, in my opinion.
Okay.
A little more earthy.
Cool.
It's, if you get a sweet Riesling, it's like candy. It's too sweet. And if you get a dry Riesling, it makes your mouth pucker.
Yeah.
But a good Gewürztraminer is like the best hot weather white you can get.
That sounds awesome.
It is wonderful. If you can't find a Gewürztraminer, get a Viognier. Viogniers, you can't, you won't go wrong with a Viognier.
Okay.
The other really good ones you want to kind of branch out are, you can get white Pinot Noir. So, I know this seems kind of weird, but the way that a red gets color, certain reds get color, like a Pinot Noir gets the red is because the pigments come out of the tannins and the wine,
mm-hmm.
right, and the rind of the grape. And that stains what the batch looks like. And then they pull the rinds out, and then they do the winemaking thing. If they just take the juice out without keeping the must in, and then they start the process, you'll get a white Pinot Noir.
Oh, wow.
Right? And but it's not a Pinot Blanc. It's the same varietal as a Pinot Noir, but it's not. It's just a different color. And you end up getting less tannins, and
mm-hmm.
it tastes a little bit differently. It tends to be a little bit sweeter, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my opinion. I may be totally wrong. A professional wine taster will call me out, but it's really, really quirky. I actually brought down a couple bottles of that 2 years ago and shared them with Eddie Campbell, and that was a trip.
That was awesome.
Well, on that note, it sounds like we've got some wines to dig up.
Yeah, I got to go investigate a whole bunch of new wines.
That took a weird turn. But
no, that's perfect. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no. That was my in-laws got me my father-in-law is very, very much into wine, and it's one of those like weird, really weird, quirky things. It's just kind of amazing.
It's really helpful to have somebody. Yeah. It's that relationship thing, Chris. It's all about who you know and what they can recommend for you.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's not even just a relationship. I think it's a conversation.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Even if the conversation, what was that that Lincoln said about the passion we have strained are cause of something? that we must not be enemies but friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well,
yeah.
On that note, thanks again for joining us today, Chris. This has been wonderful.
No problem. It was always lovely to talk to you all.
Well, and thanks to everyone who listened to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop or subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, comicstherapy.com. We'll see you next week.
Only God can judge me.
That right?
Only God, baby.
Nobody else.
Nobody else.
All you other motherfuckers, get out of my business.
Ready?
Perhaps I was blind to the facts. Stabbed in the back, I couldn't trust my own homies. Just a bunch of dirty facts. Will I succeed? Avenue from the weed. And hocus pocus try to focus, but I can't see. And in my mind, I'm a blind man doing time. Look to my future, cause my past is all behind me. Is it a crime to fight for what is mine? Everybody's done. Tell me what's the use in trying. I've been trapped since birth. Cautious, cause I'm cursed. And fantasies of my family in the hurts. And they say it's the white man I should fear. But it's my own kind doing all the killing here. I can't lie, ain't no love for the other side. Jealousy inside, make them wish I died. Oh my lord, tell me what I'm living for. Everybody's dropping, got me knocking on heaven's door. And all my memories of seeing brothers bleed. And everybody grieves, but still nobody sees. Recollect your thoughts, don't get caught up in the mix. Cause the media's full of dirty tricks. Only God can judge me.
Hi Aaron, hi Andrea, Jason Sachs here at Jason Sachs on the Twitter. On his classic 1966 album Blonde on Blonde, one of the greatest albums of the rock and roll era, Bob Dylan has a blues-style song called Temporary Like Achilles. That song contains a line that I've always heard and loved as, "How come you chose someone like him to be your God? You know I want your loving, honey, why are you so hard?" If there's one god in comics who's heard a share of blues songs and seen a share of heartache and heartbreak, it's my choice this week, Eddie Campbell's Bacchus. Bacchus is the god of wine in Greek mythology, a man who loves to party so much it's literally in his genes. He and his friends drink too much, get themselves into crazy, ridiculous adventures, hang around in bars, and do their best to enjoy life. You can see the lines of worry on his face, and the years have worn him down, as they do. But Bacchus is also a god who loves life, has a passion for everything he does, loves his friends, and just takes everything easy. There's a lesson there for all of us, I think. You know I want your lovin', honey, but you're so hard. Thanks. Bye.